Les conférences du Collège de France.
C'est un grand honneur d'avoir le professeur Sixnis ici avec nous. So Virgis, which is the easy version of his name that I always use, is a chemist by training. And he's one of these chemists who understood fairly early on that he could apply the power of chemistry to biology. And he made that transition from chemistry to biotechnology right through his career. And I guess the other thing that Virgis realized early on in his career, that if you want to understand biology, and in particular in the area of enzymology and how nucleic acids can be affected, metabolized, you need to combine chemistry, biochemistry, and structure, and structural biology. So this kind of structure-function relationship of enzymes in particular, restrictions enzymes, which is where he started, has been a thread through most of his career. And it was, I would say, his goal from early on, even before CRISPR-Cas, that, how do you understand how restriction enzymes target so specifically? What is the specificity? What is the efficiency? What directs that? So he was actually one of the first people to become interested in the CRISPR-Cas system, which, of course, is, as I'm sure everyone knows, is a version of adaptive immunity in bacteria. And he realized that actually these could potentially be amazing tools and used to get to this very, very specific targeting of the genome of nucleic acids. And so just to go back to Virgis himself and his career path, he studied at Vilnius University, which is, for those of you who haven't been to Vilnius, I recommend it. It's an amazing city, and the university is very beautiful and impressive. And he then went to Moscow to do his PhD before coming back to Vilnius. And he was in Vilnius at a time where there was this real, I would say, effervescence around restriction enzymes and molecular biology. He and I have discussed many times that for those of us who do molecular biology, I remember the days back in the late 1980s, early 90s, where we would use these enzymes that we'd buy from Fermentas. So Fermentas came from Vilnius, and Fermentas was extremely successful, not only in them being bought out ultimately by Thermo Fisher, and Thermo Fisher have their biggest site in Europe actually in Vilnius, but also in training a whole generation of scientists. Of course, it was about the people who were there who allowed all of this to happen, a whole generation of scientists. So Vilnius is really, I would say, a hotbed of molecular and structural biology. It's very impressive. And Virgis has been a key player in all of this. So since 2002, he's been a professor at Vilnius University, and he's also the chief scientist at the Institute of Biotechnology. And in fact, that was one of the reasons I got to know him several years ago, because, in fact, it's a partnership with EMBL, and it's our most successful partnership because we basically saw it rise in the space of a few years, starting in the pandemic, into one of the most successful partnerships in Europe, hiring, I think it was 6 group leaders in the midst of the pandemic, 3 of which already have ERCs and all, going super strong. So anyway, so it's a very successful ecosystem, and that is very much part of Virgis's contribution, and he has consistently tried to surround himself by people who are interested in really exploring the frontier. And so his research on CRISPR-Cas, which started, I think, in around 2007 or 2008, where there was this realization that actually this system of immunity could actually be useful for genetic and genomic engineering. He rapidly became one of the people who pioneered our understanding of how this works, and he has been honored with many, many prizes, including the Kavli Prize in 2018, alongside Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna for the invention of CRISPR-Cas9 as a tool for precision genomic editing that has revolutionized biology, agriculture, and medicine. So Virgis did not stop there. So for those of you who followed his work, he is becoming increasingly, I would say, productive and successful, despite all of the other commitments that he has with all of his various roles and responsibilities. He remains an extremely active scientist. And he's been particularly driven, I think, by the realization that although CRISPR-Cas nucleases are very, you know, versatile, they do have their problems and their challenges in terms of delivery, obviously, but also off-target effects, immune interactions. And so he has been working to try and discover other actors, and he came across this new system of RNA-directed transposon-related TNP bean nucleases. And this has opened up a new era of DNA scissors. And so he has been exploring this at many different levels, going from the very, very basic science of understanding how they work at the molecular structural level, right through to how they can be applied, not just to do genetic modifications, but to do it in a clinically relevant way. And we were just discussing about how that is moving very, very fast, including in Vilnius, where they're this kind of approach is being used to help in therapies such as CAR T therapies. So I think I'll stop there and give you a chance to speak, Virgis. It's really a pleasure to host you here. Every time I hear you, I learn a lot of new things, and so it's an honor to have you here at the Collège de France. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, and it's my pleasure and privilege to talk at Collège de France. And of course, I could stop here because Edith provided very nice synopsis of my work. But anyway, I'll do my job. And yes, so probably some of you are aware that last year, it was kind of a year of Lithuania in France. And there were many events organized in Paris and other parts of France, and we had cultural events, and we also had the rector of Vilnius University, Professor Petrauskas, talking, I guess, in the same auditorium. And he was talking about the languages there that were spoken in the Grand Duchies of Lithuania, and also about Lithuania language. And I would like to keep your focus on Lithuania and to keep your focus on science, but today I would like to talk more on biochemistry and biotechnology. And my lab is located in Vilnius, and Vilnius is the capital of Lithuania. It's located on a shores of the Baltic Sea. It looks far away, but it's only 2.5 hours direct flight from Vilnius to Paris. And Vilnius is the capital of Lithuania and is probably most famous for a number of churches. And I didn't count it, but I suspect that it's probably the largest number of churches per square kilometer in Europe. But anyway, it's a nice place, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But of course, we don't go to church every day. Just across the river, there is a modern city, and in Vilnius, the history and modern times always live together. And as it was already mentioned, Vilnius University was established in 1579, and it's one of the oldest universities in the region. And very recently, nearly 10 years ago, we moved into a brand new building of Life Science Center that was built in the new campus of Vilnius University. So why I would like to talk today about biochemistry and biotechnology, there is one reason also that is related to Professor Snedecky, who was teaching in 18th century at Vilnius University. And he published a book that was called Theory of Organic Beings. And this book actually, to some extent, laid background for modern biochemistry. And he was the first one who used the term organic chemistry, probably even in advance of Berzelius. So, but he published his work mainly in Polish language, and later it went to oblivion. But anyway, so very recently his book was translated into English, finally, after 200 years, and now it's available for wider public. So he had his interesting views on human nature, because it was 18th century, and of course the vitalistic theories of human nature were prevalent at that time. But actually, and he claimed that the existence and life, human existence and life depends on the organizing force. And this organizing force is commonly and continually acting on the organic combination in the body. But what is important that he also noticed that sometimes it also manifests on plagues, venoms, and viruses were not known at that time, but probably that would be also true to say about viruses. And actually, we all are aware that immune system protects our bodies against invading pathogenic microorganisms. And it has two branches, two arms of defense that are called innate and adaptive immunity. And they differ by molecules that provide this immune response, and also what is important, they differ by the response time. So innate immunity is able to provide response immediately, while in the case of adaptive immunity, the organisms need time to develop the adaptive immunity. However, when it's established, so then adaptive immunity is able to act immediately when it encounters a pathogen. So, and bacteria, even the pathogenic ones, they have their own enemies. And bacteriophages or viruses of bacteria, they are actually deadly parasites that infect bacteria in order to replicate, and usually kill bacteria when replication is completed. So in this respect, viruses provide a lethal threat to bacteria. However, bacteria somehow survive and multiply. And this is because bacteria, during the evolution, was able to build different layers of antiviral defense system that, taken together, provide a primitive immune system of bacteria that allows bacteria to cope with viral threats. And these different antiviral defense systems are clustered in bacteria in a so-called defense islands. And in these defense islands, the genes that encode different antiviral defense systems, like restriction modification system, CRISPR, and others, are clustered together. And actually, these systems are very important for bacteria, because in some bacteria, like in Aeruginosa, Mycobacterium aeruginosa, nearly 30% of bacterial genome is occupied by antiviral defense systems. So in my lab, we are focusing on the molecular mechanisms of different antiviral defense systems in bacteria, and we use a combination of different by chemical, biophysical, and structural methods. So we started to study antiviral defense systems in bacteria many, many years ago, and we focused on the first antiviral defense system of bacteria that is called restriction modification system. And it's a relatively simple system that is comprised of two enzymes, restriction enzyme and DNA methyltransferase. And both of them recognize short nucleotide sequences, but catalyze different chemical reactions. So restriction enzyme is able to recognize a specific sequence and cut this sequence, introducing double-strand break, while DNA methyltransferase is able to recognize the same sequence recognized by restriction enzyme and introduce methyl group on A or C basis in a specific sequence context. So when invading phage DNA comes into the cell, so then restriction endonuclease is able to recognize the phage DNA and cut it at specific sites. The host DNA is protected from the restriction enzyme cleavage because the host DNA is methylated. So in this respect, the restriction modification system functions as an innate immune system of bacteria that is able to differentiate, discriminate between self and non-self DNA by a simple methyl tag. And restriction enzymes, and in particular type 2 restriction enzymes that are widely used in the lab, so they recognize short nucleotide sequences from 4 to 6 nucleotides in length, and cut them, introducing double strand break. So the question that we wanted to address in my lab, we wanted to understand actually how restriction enzymes are able to discriminate their targets. Sometimes actually they are able to discriminate the sequences that differ by a single nucleotide. And of course, there is a large number of restriction enzyme, and now it's probably more than 4,000 different restriction enzymes known to date. And of course, then there is a question, which restriction enzyme you choose for your studies. And I always show this slide because it shows that it's the same diversity, and it's probably a proper place to show it France, because you have such a huge diversity of wines. But the problem is the same, which one you choose for your experiment. And we decided to focus on a group of restriction enzymes that recognize related nucleotide sequences that all contained a conserved CCGG tetranucleotide in the middle and different flanking nucleotides outside of the conserved sequence. And actually, we wanted to actually solve the structures of all these all restriction enzymes that belong to the to this group, in order to understand how nature actually achieves specificity for very, very related nucleotide sequences. And it looked an easy project in the beginning, but it took us nearly 20 years to solve all these structures. But finally, we managed to do it, and we had many collaborators, and we learned how to solve the crystal structures of restriction enzymes, collaborating with Professor Robert Huber at Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry, and we continue this collaboration until now. And we naively thought that if we'll be able to understand how nature designs specificity of restriction enzymes, so we saw that maybe we can, based on the same principles, maybe we can engineer restriction enzymes that would be able to cut any desired nucleotide sequences. And you know that restriction enzymes are very important tools in molecular biology that actually promoted development of recombinant DNA technology. And of course, restriction enzymes with improved specificity or different specificities would be really helpful tools in molecular biology. But we also thought that maybe we can engineer restriction enzymes that would be able, that could be used also as gene editing tools. And of course, this restriction enzyme, it's a problem because restriction enzymes recognize usually short nucleotide sequences up to 8 nucleotide in length. And there are many such sequences in the genome. But anyway, when we started to engineer specificities of the restriction enzymes, it turned out that it's a really challenging task because actually restriction enzymes recognize their target sequences using amino acid residues located on the protein. And these amino acid residues actually make hydrogen bond and van der Waals interaction with donor and acceptor sites that are located on the base edges in the target sequence. So if you like to engineer the new specificity of restriction enzymes, so you need to change these amino acid residues that interact. But of course, it's not that simple. And it's possible to engineer new specificities of restriction enzymes, but these engineered enzymes are not as good as enzymes that you can find in nature. And even if you engineer these variants, so these variants are prone for off-target cleavage, and in the restriction enzyme field, this off-target cleavage is usually called a star activity that is very familiar for many of you who are using restriction enzymes. So at some point after 20 years, I got a bit tired by studying restriction enzymes and then started to look for something new. And then in 2007, a paper appeared in Science Journal that claimed that CRISPR provides acquired resistance against viruses in prokaryotes. So the major message in the paper was that there is a new antiviral defense system in bacteria. And of course, it looked very interesting for me, and I decided to go for it. And I wrote an email to Philippe asking to share the strain. And after several months of email exchange, the strain finally appeared in our lab, and we were able to start to study this, the CRISPR systems that were available in that were present in this bacterial host. But actually, how the CRISPR system works? So the detailed molecular mechanism was not clear, but Philippe was able and Rudolf were able to propose the general mechanism of immunity provided by CRISPR systems. So when phage nucleic acid invades the bacteria, so most of the bacteria die. However, some of them survive, and it turned out that survivors were able to incorporate small pieces of the invading phage DNA into a so-called CRISPR array. And then bacteria was able to transcribe these pieces of viral DNA into short RNA molecules that were called CRISPR RNA. And these short RNA molecules, together with Cas proteins that are encoded by Cas genes, were able to form ribonucleoprotein complexes that were able to destruct invading viral DNA during the next round of infection. So in this respect, CRISPR-Cas system functions as an adaptive immune system because it can memorize the invader by inserting pieces of invader's DNA into the CRISPR array, and then use this information to recognize the invader and destruct the invading phage. So the science paper published in 2007, it described CRISPR systems that were present in Streptococcus thermophilus host. And this bacteria is very important and it's also related to France for making cheese and yogurts. And Philippe and Rudolf, they are working at Danisco Company at that time, trying to understand how to make starter cultures that are resistant to viruses that actually cause a big problem for the industry. And in Streptomorphologists, they actually discovered four different CRISPR-Cas systems that actually belongs to different types. And of course, when we look at these CRISPR-Cas systems, we got the same choice problem, which one you choose for your study. And we decided to focus on a CRISPR-3 system of Streptomorphologists because of two reasons. First, it contained the smallest number of genes in the locus, of Cas genes in the locus. And next, one of the proteins encoded by Cas9 gene, in fact, it had amino acid residues at the putative active site that we have seen before in restriction enzymes. So that was a kind of our guess that this Cas9 protein could be a protein that could be somehow involved in interference. So, and of course, we didn't know how to work with Streptomorphologists. It's very different host. And in the lab, E. coli and it still is a workhorse. And to make our life easier, we decided to transfer the CRISPR-3 system of Streptomorphologists into E. coli. And in fact, this experiment worked. We were able to transfer the CRISPR-3 system in E. coli, and we shown that actually this CRISPR-3 system in E. coli is able to provide interference against invading phages or plasmid if a matching spacer is present in the CRISPR array. And then using the genetic tools that are easily available in E. coli, we were able to show that the Cas9 is the only gene that is required for interference. And in fact, it was the first demonstration that CRISPR systems are transportable, that you can take a CRISPR system from one bacteria and transfer it to another. It's still a functional unit. So then, of course, the next obvious step was just to try to isolate Cas9 protein, and Gedris Gassounas, who was at that time a PhD student in the lab, was able to isolate Cas9, and he demonstrated that Cas9 actually purified together with two RNA molecules that are called CRISPR RNA and tracer RNA, and then using a set of biochemical experiments, we were able to demonstrate that actually Cas9 protein guided by CRISPR RNA is able to recognize target sequence in the DNA, and then Cas9 protein actually cuts the DNA, introducing double-strand break using two different active sites. And so in fact, Cas9 functions as RNA guiding restriction endonuclease, and I'm always telling that it's a bit ironic that I switched to CRISPR because I was a bit tired to study restriction enzymes, but ended up again with a restriction enzyme. But there is one important difference that actually differently from restriction enzymes, where specificity is achieved through hydrogen bond and van der Waals interactions between amino acid residues and atoms on the base edges. In the case of Cas9, the specificity is achieved through the Watson-Crick interactions between RNA and DNA and DNA target. And the simple modular organization of Cas9 protein, where specificity is provided by RNA and cleavages provided by Cas9 protein actually paved the way for engineering of programmable restriction enzymes. And simply by changing RNA in the RNP, you can target Cas9 to nearly any sequence in the genome, and then Cas9 will introduce double-strand break that could be harnessed for making knockouts or knock-ins. And of course, during last 10 years, Cas9 became a really dominant tool in genome editing field in very different model organisms. So when we so if you look at this timeline, so before BC in, and BC stands before Cas9, the Cas9 in fact was a part of one of antiviral defense systems is in bacteria that was probably interested for a very small bunch of people. But AC, that means after Cas9, actually it became a genome editing tool that actually triggered a revolution in genome editing. And for me, it's a very nice illustration that actually the line between the basic or fundamental research and application or technologies is very thin and very narrow. One day it could be a peculiar system that is interested for only a limited number of people, but other day it could become in fact a technology that finally led to the Nobel Prize. So, and then Cas9 became a really versatile genome editing tool that could do very, very important things. For example, using this tool, now it's possible to cure mutations that cause genetic disease, and sickle cell disease is, of course, a classical example. And of course, Cas9 is a great tool that is already in the clinic, but there are still some challenges that need to be overcome. And one of the challenges is a targeting space limitation, because Cas9 requires a PAM sequence to initiate DNA cleavage, and I will talk about the PAM requirement in the next couple of slides. But of course, the question is how you can address these challenges, and there are two different approaches. One is just you can take the existing Cas9 and try to engineer it in order to overcome PAM limitation. And there is an alternative approach that you can look at the diversity of Cas9 and then try to find Cas9 proteins that would be able to recognize different PAM sequences. And we focused on the natural diversity approach. And the CRISPR-Cas systems are really very, very diverse, and they are largely divided in two classes, class 1 and class 2, depending on the structure of the so-called effector complex. For example, in the class 2, and that is exemplified by Cas9 and Cas12 proteins, the effector complex is a single protein that binds guide RNA molecule. In the case of class 1, the effector complex is a multi-subunit complex that binds guide RNA. And within the class 2 that relies on a single protein effector complex, there are further types. So type 2 is exemplified by Cas9 protein. And type 5 is exemplified by Cas12 protein that is also these days used for genome editing experiments. And type 6 actually is allocated for the Cas proteins like Cas13 that are able to target RNA instead of the DNA. So, as I said before, the PAM requirement actually limits the Cas9 targeting space, because the specificity of Cas9 is provided by Watson-Crick interactions between part of the guide RNA and complementary DNA strand. However, in order to initiate binding of guide RNA to the DNA target, the Cas9 protein has to recognize PAM sequence, and recognition PAM sequence causes deformation of the DNA and helps RNA to base pair with DNA. So different Cas9 proteins, they actually show different PAM requirements. And this PAM requirement is quite an important requirement, because especially when you think about targeting some sites, for example, that bear mutations very, very precisely. And for example, for asparaginase Cas9, the GGPAM that is quite widespread still constrains targeting to every 8 base pairs in the human genome, making large part of mutations associated with human diseases non-accessible if a very precise targeting is considered. So the reason that actually Cas9 proteins that could be present in different bacteria could help to overcome this targeting space limitation problem. And in order to identify these Cas9 orthologs, we actually developed a phylogeny-guided bioinformatic approach. We identified CRISPR arrays and then looked for Cas9 proteins in the vicinity of these CRISPR arrays. And we were able to actually identify thousands of Cas9 orthologs that and this information was used to build a phylogenetic tree that, in fact, had 10 different Cas9 protein families. And then we decided to characterize the Cas9 proteins that belong to different Cas9 families, and we selected 100 of Cas9 orthologs that actually were present in different Cas9 families, and aimed to characterize their PAM requirement. And for each new Cas9 ortholog, two requirements need to be established. First, it's guide RNA sequence, and then the PAM requirement. So the guide RNA sequence can be predicted bioinformatically, but to establish PAM sequence, you need to develop some kind of experimental approach. And in the lab, we developed a very simple experimental approach that allowed us to interrogate PAM requirements for different Cas9 proteins. So we engineered a plasmid DNA library that contained a single target that was complementary to the guide RNA that is present in Cas9 protein, and then actually randomized 7 nucleotides in the vicinity of the target sequence, which would correspond to PAM. And then actually we expressed different Cas9 orthologs in the in vitro transcription and translation mixture, and use this mixture actually to cleave the plasmid DNA library. And then we actually captured cleavage products by adaptal ligation, and deep sequenced them, and found the PAM sequences that actually license library cleavage. And when we analyzed all these 100 Cas9 orthologs, we found that indeed the Cas9 proteins show very, very different PAM requirements. Some of them recognize C-rich sequences, some of them recognize A-rich sequences, some of them recognize T-rich sequences. So actually, we were able to expand the library of Cas9 PAM sequences to really large numbers. So we think that these Cas9 orthologs, we thought initially that these Cas9 orthologs could help us to overcome the PAM limitation problems. And another limitation of the Cas9 technology is related to the delivery. So in gene editing experiments, especially related to human therapeutics, The AAV vectors are desirable delivery tool. However, the AAV vectors, they have their own packaging capacity limit. And therefore, in order to package, it's a problem to package Cas9, the gene encoding Cas9 protein together with guide RNA into a single AAV particle. So therefore, in order to avoid this problem, people were using sometimes split Cas9 genes and using double AAV infection to that allowed to reassemble the Cas9 protein. So again, there are two approaches that could be used to solve this problem. You can probably make truncations of Cas9 protein to try to get smaller Cas9 variants, and some people actually followed this path. And another approach, again, look at the natural diversity of the Cas9 Cas proteins. And then, actually, we focused on the specific family, specific type of CRISPR-Cas system that is called type 5 CRISPR-Cas system. And the signature protein for this type 5 CRISPR-Cas system is Cas12 protein. And in contrast to Cas9, that contains two different active sites, and each active site is able to cleave a particular DNA strand, the Cas12 proteins, they contain a single RFC active site, and this single RFC active site is able to cut both DNA strands. And the Cas12 proteins that belong to type 5 CRISPR-Cas family, they are very, 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 very diverse, and they all have the concept RFC active site, but they differ very much in size. And some of them, like Cas12F proteins that belong to this family, they are really small, and their size is around 5 or 400. So therefore, we call these Cas12F proteins miniature proteins. And then, of course, building on our experience on the studies of Cas9 orthologs, we decided to actually express Cas12F family proteins, and we selected 10 of them and identify their DNA cleavage requirements using the same approach that we used for the Cas9 orthologs, cleavage of plasmid DNA library. This assay, in fact, have shown that Cas12F family proteins are able to cleave double-stranded DNA in a PAM-dependent manner, introducing double-strand break. And again, the PAM sequence was required for the Cas12F protein cleavage. And these PAM sequences that came out from our screen actually were different. Most of Cas12F proteins required the T-rich PAM, but some of them actually also targeted C-rich PAM sequences. And then actually, in probably in a year or so, when we reported about the double-strand DNA cleavage properties of Cas12F family proteins, a number of papers appeared that showed that, in fact, people were able to package these proteins into AAVs and use them to engineer human cells or different model systems. So these experiments, in fact, showed you that the exploration of natural diversity of CRISPR-Cas system allowed us to identify Cas9 orthologs that show different PAM requirements and identify miniature nucleases that are much smaller than Cas9 or Cas12 and could be used for the AAV delivery. And you already know that actually, indeed, Cas9 and Cas12, they are advancing into the clinics, there are many phase one clinical trials, but finally last year there were a couple of actually approved trials using Cas9 technology for treatment of genetic disease. So, but the interesting remaining basic question in the field was where all these Cas9 and Cas12 proteins came from. And if you look at the phylogenetic tree of Cas12 family, you can see that this phylogenetic tree is very diverse. There are many, many different subtypes of Cas12 family. And all of them, in fact, contain a conserved active site, or Fc active site, but they differ in size. So the Cas12F miniature nucleases that I just described, they are pretty small, 400-500 amino acid residues. The Cas12As is pretty large protein, and there are also proteins of intermediate size. But if you look at this tree, actually, the closest relative of the Cas12F protein family is a protein that is called TNPB. And TNPB, in fact, it has nothing to do with CRISPR systems, because in all the Cas12 family members, in the vicinity of the Cas12 proteins, there is a CRISPR array. But actually, when you look at the TNPB, there is no CRISPR array around. But TNPB still contains a conserved RAPC active site. And of course, it was a question where this TNPB protein came from. And that TNPB, in fact, is a member of the bacterial transposons or insertion sequences that belong to this specific insertion sequence, insertion sequence families. And it's these insertion sequences are a mobile elements in the bacterial genomes. And these are actually very simple and probably most of the ancient bacterial transposons, because they are really very, very simple. They are often comprised of a single TNPA gene that sometimes is accompanied by TNPB gene. And then these two genes are flanked by left and right sequences, and also a short TTGAT, a short nucleotide sequence, is important for transposition. And transposition of these insertion sequences occurs during DNA replication. So the TNPA gene encodes a transposase that enables transposon mobility. And this transposase actually excites the insertion sequence during DNA replication from the lagging DNA strand. And then actually this secular transposition intermediate is inserted into different location in bacterial genome that is specified by this TTGAT GAT sequence. So while the role of TNPA was in transposition was clear and it was discovered more than probably 30 or 40 years ago, the role of TNPB was still enigmatic. So, and we decided to look at the TNPB function, and we focused on a specific transposon that is present in Deinococcus radiodurans bacteria, and Gytis Druteika and Tautvydas Karvelis in the lab, they actually expressed the TNPB protein in E. coli together with another plasmid that actually contained the intact intact transposon, but TNPA gene was inactivated to avoid DNA mobility. And then actually they were able to isolate TNPB protein from heterologous E. coli host, and they isolated TNPB, and they actually found that TNPB copurified with nucleic acid, it copurified with RNA molecule. And when we isolated this RNA molecule from TNPB complex, we found that indeed, actually, this RNA molecule is encoded by the TNPB, partially encoded by the 3' end of the TNPB gene. And it also contained the sequence complementary to the right transposon elements and 60 nucleotide sequence that corresponded to the plasmid. So since this sequence contained the right transposon element, we called it rare RNA. So next obvious question was, okay, TNPB forms a complex with RNA, so is this complex functionally active? And in order to address this question, actually, we again used this biochemical assay that we developed for the Cas9 orthologs and Cas12 miniature nucleases. We actually expressed TNPB protein in E. coli together with rare RNA, and then actually used the cell lysate to cleave plasmid DNA library that contained the target sequence that was complementary to the part of the sequence of rare RNA present in the TNPB complex, and this sequence was flanked by seven nucleotide variable variable sequence. And we captured cleavage products, sequenced them, and we found that indeed TNPB was able to cut double-stranded DNA, introducing a double-strand break, very much similar to Cas12 or Cas9 nucleases. And what was interesting, that in fact, the TNPB was able to cleave double-stranded DNA when a TTGAT sequence was present in the vicinity of the target site. So, but again, this is the same sequence that is required for transposon mobility. So therefore, we called this sequence a transposon-associated motif. It's a bit similar to the protospacer-associated motif that is present in Cas9 proteins. So taken together, these data show that TNPB, in fact, is a ribonuclear protein complex that contains rare RNA that is able to target a specific sequence. But for the cleavage of the DNA, actually, the TAM sequence has to be just in the vicinity of the target sequence that is targeted by the guide RNA. But if you look at the transposon or insertion sequence, you have this TTGAT sequence on the left end, and the target sequence that is targeted by the guide RNA that is present in TNPB in the right end. So in this case, the recognition site for TNPB is disrupted by the insertion sequence, and TNPB is unable to cleave this DNA. However, when the transposon is excised, so the target site for TNPB is reassembled, and then TNPB is able to cleave this DNA. So this allowed us to propose the mechanism of transposition the role of the TNPB in the transposition mechanism of this particular transposon family. So when the transposon is excised from the lagging DNA strand during the transposition, after transposon excision, actually two different alleles are produced. In one, the allele that originated from the lagging strand, the transposon is missing. In another allele that originated from the leading strand, the transposon is still present. So then, actually, but in the allele where transposon is missing, the target site for TNPB recognition is reconstituted. And then TNPB is able to cut this DNA, introducing double-strand break, and trigger a homologous recombination that reinstates the transposon copy that was lost from the lagging strand during transposon replication. And it's, in fact, a mechanism that allows to ensure that if the transposition was unsuccessful for some reasons, so that transposon is not lost. And then actually it at least could be reinstated at the same at the same cleavage at the same site. So taken together, all this data demonstrated, okay, the TNPB is a programmable nuclease, and of course the obvious thing was to check whether TNPB is able to cut DNA in human cells, and actually we showed that indeed it's able to introduce double-strand breaks in eukaryotic cells with at some sites with really decent activity. So indicating that TNPB, in fact, could be harnessed as the genome editing tool. And the next, of course, it was interesting to see actually how the TNPB protein looks like, and Gedra Sosnauskas, Gedra Tomulaitene in the lab, and together with Guillermo Montoya at in Copenhagen, managed to solve that TNPB structure using a cryo-EM. And it revealed that TNPB protein, in fact, is comprised of two different lobes, a rec lobe and NUC lobe. And actually, the RUFC active site is located in the NUC lobe. But in this case, actually, RNA occupied a very large part of the complex. I just didn't mention before that the RNA that is in TNPB complex is around 550 nucleotide residues in length. So it's quite a large RNA. And then actually, when we got the structure of TNPB complex, so we were able to compare the TNPB structure with structures that were available for different Cas12 family proteins. And what with structural comparison revealed, it revealed that TNPB is indeed most similar, structurally similar, to the Cas12F miniature nucleases. So, and even the RNAs that are present in TNPB and Cas12 nucleases, they are of similar size. However, it was one important difference. So the Cas12 miniature nucleases are in fact dimers, but TNPB protein is a monomer, and it's still not clear actually why Cas12F proteins are dimers and TNPB can do the job as a monomer. So, and the most distant relative of TNPB was Cas12A protein. And in the case of Cas12A protein, minimal TNPB core is conserved, but it actually, there are different elaborations in the conserved TNPB core in the case of Cas12A protein. But the important feature is that in the case of Cas12A, the RNA is pretty small. So, and people now speculate that probably some of the functions of the RNA were overtaken by protein in Cas12A protein. So that's kind of interesting evolutionary speculation. So these data actually revealed that TNPB is an evolutionary predecessor of the Cas12 protein family. And Česlovas Venslovas and Darius Kozlauskas in the bioinformatics lab at the Life Science Center, they were able to actually compare the TNPB sequences with sequences of different Cas12 family proteins. And what they found that indeed the sequence space for TNPB is the most abundant. There are millions TNPB sequences, and Cas12 proteins that belong to different family, they form much smaller groups, and this is also consistent that probably the TNPB was evolved, the Cas12 family proteins evolved from TNPBs. And of course, this very huge TNPB family implies that probably you can find different TNPB variants that could actually show different biochemical cleavage requirements. And just as a small exercise, we took 10 different TNPB sequences from different bacteria and actually established the biochemical cleavage requirements using the assays that we developed that I described before. And what we found indeed that TNPBs are also require TAM sequences, and these TAM sequences are different for TNPB proteins. Some of them actually are specific for G-rich sequences. Most of them are specific for TA-rich sequences. So, in this part of my talk, I actually described you two different antiviral defense systems, restriction modification system and CRISPR-Cas system. And these different systems actually target the invading phage DNA. So this is the strategy that these two systems are using. One of them functions as an innate immune system, another one as adaptive immune system, but the main the target is invading phage DNA. But the question was, are there any targets and strategies for that bacteria use to cope with invading phages? And a few years ago, Rotem Sorenk in Weizmann Institute described a so-called TORIS bacterial antiviral system. And it's quite simple system that is comprised of two genes, THSA and THSB. And THSA gene is actually encodes a protein that contains two different domains, a SIR2 domain that is similar to sirtuins, and also a SLOG domain. The THSB gene encodes a protein that shows similarities to TIR proteins. So, and Rotem and his colleagues, they proposed a following mechanism of the antiviral defense provided by TORIS antiviral defense system. So when phage infects the cell, and in this case it was bacillus cells, so then THSB protein somehow senses invading phage DNA, and then actually it uses NAD that is present in a cell to synthesize a cyclic ADP isomer. And this cyclic ADP isomer is actually bound to the THSA protein, and then initiates the NAD degrading activity of the THAS protein that results in the NAD degradation in the cell and growth arrest. So that was the mechanism proposed by Rotem, but it was not clear, in fact, how this cyclic ADP isomer is able to activate THAS-A protein. And to address this question, Gedra Temulaitina and other people in the lab actually used cryo-EM to solve the structure of THSA protein. And when they make a grid of THS protein in the presence of THSB and NAD, what they seen on the grid, they'd seen long filaments that were comprised of THSA protein. And in fact, it turned out that THS-A protein is make tetramers using SIR2 domains as a core, and SLOG domains are exposed on the surface of the on the opposite side of the SIR2 core. And in actually, all these tetramers stack to each other, forming really large large helical filaments. And of course, it could be an artifact that resulted because you just put something on a grid, or you had something already in solution that is aggregated a protein. So therefore, in order to check whether these helical filaments are functionally active, so they, the Gedra and other people, they engineered mutants at the tetramer interface or at the interface that actually is covered by these tetramers in the helical filament. And what they found, that these mutations at the interface, in fact, resulted in the destruction of the filament. So when these mutations were introduced using DLS light scattering experiments, the helical filaments were not present. So, and it's important that these helical filaments were actually important for NAD degradation activity. So when the same mutations that disrupted the filament formation, in fact, disrupted the NAD's activity of the THS-A protein, indicating that these filaments are in fact functional entities that provide interference against phage by depleting NAD from the cell. And actually, this allowed us to revise the mechanism, adding an important step in the mechanism, that the cyclic ADP isomer synthesized by THSB is then captured by SLOG domains of the THSA protein and triggers polymerization of the THSA protein that in fact switches on the NAD degradation activity. So during recent years, actually, different strategies were reported, not only the NAD degradation, but also bacteria use different targets are used by bacteria to cope with viral infection. So, for example, NTP pool could be exhausted, and NTPs are important for phage replication. This stops phage replication, but of course, the bacteria growth is also arrested. And also, there are systems that actually makes holes in the membrane, and that's kind of also result in the bacterial death. So now hundreds of antiviral defense systems are discovered, and in 2 weeks in Pasteur it will be a meeting on different antiviral defense systems in bacteria. So why they are important? So if you look backwards, so discoveries and studies of restriction enzyme in 1960s, 1980s resulted in the discovery of restriction enzymes that resulted in recombinant DNA technology. So studies of CRISPR-Cas systems in 2000, in the beginning of this century, actually resulted in genome editing technology, and both these technologies culminated in Nobel Prizes. So now we have hundreds of new systems identified, and the question is, what awaits us here? And my answer is, I don't know, but this makes your life interesting and makes science interesting. But what I guess is awaiting us it's new chemistries and new discoveries that could result in new technologies. And this is probably a very important message. And finally, I would like to acknowledge people who contributed to this work. So people from my lab, and also our recent collaborators, Guillermo Montoya and Arturo Carabias at the Novo Nordisk Foundation Center for Protein Research. And also, I would like to acknowledge our collaborators in different companies, the Kazem company that we established in Vilnius, and also Corteva Agriscience and New England Biolabs. And thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.